Well, I think we'll go ahead and get started. I don't know if we'll get any more show up. It's always hit and miss as to what the crowd is going to look like at these ASA events. We're experimenting a little bit. We've had a Rocky Mountain ASA section for years and years and years that goes primarily in Denver is where all the action is, but we're thinking about getting something going here in Fort Collins. Lynn's calling it the Fort Collins Northern Colorado section. I'm calling it the Colorado State section. We're just experimenting a little bit. So I'm going to say a little bit about the ASA in the talk as part of sort of the faith perspective that's there. But there's some info here at the front table. These actually are older copies of our journal, over 10 years old, but that some of the articles in there are really quite relevant and pertinent, and so they're free. Take what you want if you know somebody who might be interested in some of the things that are talked about there. But I just had a stack of giveaways in my garage and thought this would be a good introduction for some people. And then there's a flyer over here about the ASA, and you'll see the website. There's also a little promo flyer for a book that I've written on topics related to this with a colleague in the chemistry department, Tony Rapay. It's called Energy, What the World Needs Now. And it's an ebook only, but you can find information about a table of contents and so on that little flyer. So, just before we jump in, I want to try to capture your interest a little bit by saying what we're going to do tonight is we're going to look at kind of the state of the world around the area of energy, but with a almost 100-year time frame. And it's going to make the Green New Deal and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's proposal look like it's a tiny little problem compared to what we're really, really facing. So let me just jump in with the ASA and what that's about, because what we're going to do is look at this and think about this from a little bit of a Christian perspective, and you might wonder why Christians would be particularly interested in global energy needs and things like that, and so I want to make a case for that. So the American Scientific Affiliation, if you've never heard of it before, is about an 80-year-old organization. It's a network of Christians in the sciences. Okay, so has kind of fundamentalist evangelical roots, but it's, I don't know, broadened from that background. It still is a strongly evangelical organization, but it is a broad group. Many denominations are represented by the membership, and so on. And basically we see ourselves with these two bold things, one on this slide and one on the next, that I've used to sort of outline the statement of faith for our organization. So we take our faith seriously. So as scientists, we don't see a problem with being a Christian and being a scientist. And so we accept take scripture seriously and think about all the issues around us from a biblical perspective. And you know, we're sort of in the orthodox Christian tradition. We basically hold to the ecumenical creeds. And so anybody who's sort of in that big tent as believers is welcome and participates in our conversation. But we also take our science seriously, okay? And this is where I want to say a little bit more. So we think that the practice of science is fully consistent with Christianity. Okay, that God created the heavens and the earth. He preserves it, governs it, and he calls us to study it. We'll see some of those verses in just a second. But it's because God has made the world in a way that we can study it and understand it, and there's a pattern and consistency and regularity. That's what we need to do science. And, you know, Christians believe that's the way God made the world. Now, non-Christians, atheists, other scientists believe that the world is regular and has consistent patterns, and you can figure out things by studying it and looking at it. So we can actually work in common with non-Christians in doing science. And for the most part, there are places where a Christian scientist might poke at the edges of mainstream science and think about things a little bit differently. But for the most part, ASA scientists and Christian scientists in general practice mainstream science. You know, we're in departments in public secular universities. We don't have to be isolated in special Christian colleges or environments. And the fourth one is where we're going to pick up for the most part for tonight. So the fourth plank of the ASA Statement of Faith is that we recognize our responsibility as stewards of God's creation to use science and technology for the good of humanity and the whole world. Okay, so there's a distinct service component, not just to other people and to human beings, but to the whole world. Okay, there's a work that we do that, in a sense, is under God, to his glory, for him. And this idea of stewarding is super important. And so some of the verses, just a couple of things real quick from this. And, you know, if you've thought about this very much, the Genesis 1 account has this thing that we call the cultural mandate. Be fruitful and multiply is in there. Fill, replenish the earth. We might talk about that in a few minutes when we get to some population discussion. Subdue it. Bring it under control. Rule, have dominion, be in charge of, be masters. Okay, so from a biblical perspective, there is a special place for human beings. You know, a lot of modern environmentalism and secular thought is pushing human beings down relative to other organisms. But I think in practice, everybody recognizes there's a special place, there are special abilities that we have as human beings, and we have this role. But having dominion, being in charge of, requires knowledge, okay? And that's part of what science is, learning about God's creation so we can do the tasks that God has given us to do. Stewardship mandate, I kind of made that up. I don't know if I've ever heard anybody put it exactly that way, but Genesis 2:15, there's a secondary command given to Adam in the garden. Work and take care of. That's the NIV. But other translations use cultivate the garden, dress the garden, till the garden, tend it, keep, watch over, guard, okay? And we have those ideas that we are to be caretakers of God's world. There's a preservation aspect to that. But there's also a development aspect to that, that we bring out the full potential of the earth as God has given it to us. And then the great commandment. This is Jesus summarizing the law, love God and love your neighbor. Okay, that's part of our task as well. And so this idea of stewards of creation for the good of humanity and the whole world. Now, I have one more sort of overarching biblical perspective slide here, and that is this passage from Matthew 25, the parable of the stewards. And remember the story, the master gave one of his servants, 10 talents, and one of them five, and one of them one. And it appears, the way the story ends, that he expected that servant to go and get more back, right? He commended the two for turning their 10 into 10 into 10 more, and their 5 into 5 more. And what did he do to the one who only buried it so that he would be able to return it to the master at the end? Okay? You wicked, lazy servant, Jesus says. And he expected his servant to use this to use what was given to him to develop, make the best out of it, accomplish more from it than initially. So, you know, when we talk about this idea of stewardship, sometimes, and the larger environmental movement has some thinking about this, and I think the Christian version of that is gets into this sometimes, where our task is to merely preserve. Now, I think preservation is an important part. You know, we're to look after God's creation. We're to protect wilderness. We're to be worried about species going extinct, especially when it's our doing that does it. Stewardship also involves bringing out the potential. Okay, so maybe going beyond what is fundamentally, basically there that's given to us and bringing more out of it. And that's kind of where we're going to end up thinking. You know, all of our discussions of technology and energy use and, lights and heat and protection from the environment that we have is not just preserving wilderness, right? We've got a huge built environment here that makes it possible for us to do the things that we do as people, as servants of God. Okay, so this is New York. I wasn't able to identify the location of that picture, but this is New York at about 1900. Okay, and none of us go back that far, quite, but it's not that long ago. And this is a modern city. And, people who have, whose lives span a lot of that time, I would think of my grandmother who's now passed away, but she was born in the early 1900s and passed away in the 1990s. And so lived through a lot of this. She would recognize maybe both of these. Okay, so that's 100 years approximately. Okay, and so lots of changes. Different worlds. Some of us might not even recognize the world from 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I mean, these things, which are everywhere and dominate our intercourse now, didn't exist 20 years ago. But that 100-year period is substantial. And so we're going to think about 2100. Okay, so Kenny Chesney has a song, Don't Blink. That's the advice that a 100-year-old man on his birthday is giving everybody else, because life will go by so fast And this is kind of representing that. Well, what I want us to do today is I want you to blink twice, and we'll be at 2100. Okay? It's not going to be that long. I probably won't be around, but some of you might. Okay, so we're going to talk through, there are really four hooks for this talk and this discussion. So one is involving population. Okay, so here's the population clock from the, census.gov, the pop clock. It's actually actively turning in live on the internet. And, you can find out what the world's population is and the U.S. population is right this minute. Okay. The U.S. population moves a little bit slower than the world population, but I, clipped this out at 2:05 on Tuesday. Okay. So U.S. population was 329 million people, and the world population 7.56 billion people. Okay, I've started rounding up. And so now instead of saying 7.5 billion, which I've been saying for a few years, 8 billion. Okay, we're at 8 billion people in the world. And just because we're going to look at the energy demands from these different countries here, China is at 1.39 billion. Okay. So that's one-fifth. India is at 1.31 billion. The population growth rate of India is much higher than the population growth rate of China. And so by 2025, for sure, India will be the most populous country in the world and will surpass China. Africa, I know Africa's not a country, but we're gonna pool all of Africa together, and it's the same population as a continent as India is, so 1.31 billion. And it's probably got the fastest population growth rate of any of these mentioned here. And so, when we're talking 10, 20 years down the line with a large population growth rate, Africa is soon going to be the largest population center in the world. European Union is 513 million. That's just a little higher than the United States. All right, so this is just to give us a feel for populations. So then the other thing we're going to look at, so I'm going to keep that in the background. But we're going to look at the energy use of the world and these countries. Now, I'm going to use a unit that is a metric unit. It's probably very unfamiliar to you. It's called exajoules. A joule is close to, let's just say a kilojoule is in the range of a nutritional calorie. Okay, there are 4 joules, roughly 4 joules in a nutritional calorie. Okay, so that's a unit of energy in your food. So we're just going to use that because I'm a science guy, and we really need to get rid of all those weird non-metric units that don't make any sense and confuse. I pity my international students in some of my chemistry classes, because we work on unit conversions, and all the Americans are using the English system on some of these things, and the Chinese students have to deal with that, and they shouldn't. Okay, so exajoule, exa is the metric prefix, about kilo and centi and milli, we know some of those things. Exa is 10 to the 18th. That's a billion, billion. Okay? And that's the unit of energy we use when we're talking about the energy use of the whole world or the countries of the world. A large major metropolitan center like New York would be in the 5 exajoule range. The United States as a whole is around 100 exajoules, okay, 94.
Is this per day?
This is per year, per year. Yeah, thank you. That's a good... So the whole world uses 566 exajoules in a year. You know, those of you who know about these things, you know, energy per time is power. So energy per year is actually a unit of power. But I'm going to keep referring to it as an energy unit because it's the amount of energy used in a year. China, in about 2010, surpassed the United States in its energy use. We were the leader for the longest time, but China is now 131 exajoules, U.S. is 94, European Union is 71, India is 32, and Africa, again the continent, is 19, okay? So this comes from the BP, British Petroleum Statistical Review of Energy, World Energy. If you're interested in energy things, that report comes out every year, and it's really great to read. Just lots and lots of numbers and statistics. Again, if you follow the energy world in America and in our, say, heating and cooling industry, we use BTUs, right, British Thermal Units. The large number, a quadrillion BTUs is known as a quad, and that's in the same range as exajoules. Okay. All right, now, you know when you go out for pizza at Old Chicago's, you order your pizza, your drinks, everything. And you have, you know, 5 or 6 people there, and you have to figure out what the bill is at the end that everybody needs to pay. And so, get the check, sort of figure out what tip you're going to give, and then to figure out how much each person owes, what do?
Divide.
You divide by the number of people there, right? If you're going to evenly distributed. All right. So we're going to do some math here tonight, but the math never gets harder than that. Okay? And in fact, the very first thing we're going to do is exactly that. We're going to take the total amount of energy that each country uses or that the world uses, divide by the number of people, and get what we call a per capita energy use for that country. Okay? I don't know if this is preaching or being thankful for blessings or what, but if you look at these numbers, right, U.S. Uses 17% of the world's energy, okay, of the total amount of energy in the world. And the U.S. has, 300 million out of 8 billion people, right? So 0.3 billion out of 8 billion. So that's what they say here. 4.3% of the world's population, that's us, uses 17% of its energy resources. So it's just something to pause to think about in terms of, economic justice, social justice issues, equity between people in the world. I think as we think about serving the rest of the world, we've been blessed with lots of resources and made good use of them. And, I think from a Christian perspective particularly, we ought to be serving others with those blessings. Okay, well, here's the math. It's the energy use, so 10 to the 18th. That's the exa prefix, divided by the population. So 7.56 billion or times 10 to the 9. And you get this number here, 75 in the first case times 10 to the ninth. 10 to the ninth in the metric system is giga. Okay, so gigajoules per person. That's our unit of energy use. So the whole world, on average, uses 75 gigajoules per person. The United States uses 286. Okay, four times as much energy as the average world citizen. Okay, European Union use 138. Okay, and you know, we're gonna make the point that we consider Europe to be a developed part of the world, but they can be fully developed and have economic prosperity and other kinds of prosperity without using nearly as much energy as we do. Right. China is, you know, every time I do these statistics every year, it increases. So they're moving from just being an average to getting close. They're not even close to the U.S., so one-third of the amount of energy per person there. India, 24, and Africa, 15. Okay. Now, because you don't use the idea of gigajoules in everyday life, I wanted you to see this. So when you burn a tank of gas in your car, 15 gallons or so, the heat produced by burning one tank of gas is 2 gigajoules. Okay? So compare that to the African, right? So you fill up your gas tank 7 times and burn it doing the travel that you do, and you've used as much energy as an average African does just doing everything. Okay? So we are very energy rich, very energy prosperous, and some parts of the world are not. Okay. All right, so this, so that idea of population and energy use is one plank. The other little piece, another little piece here is something that's called the, I guess I should have written that out, Human Development Index, HDI. It's a metric that's based on life expectancy, years of education, and per capita income. It may not be the perfect measure. There are critics, but it's a measure of how developed a particular country is. Okay, so the Human Development Index. And this map shows it in quartiles. So it's a ranking from 0 to 1. And the richest countries, most developed countries, are the dark blue. And you see, you know, North America, Europe, Australia, Russia, Argentina, and Chile are in that top quarter. And the bottom is the white here, and Sub-Saharan and Central Africa are the poorest countries. All right, so the richest countries in the world have HDI indexes 0.8 to 0.9 out of 1. And the poorest countries, Burundi, the Congo, the Central African Republic, South Sudan, Mali, Sierra Leone, those countries in Central Africa are around 0.4, 0.5, okay? And then the other countries you see there, the medium blue and the light blue are in between. Okay, so we've ranked the world in country by their state of development. And by and large, almost everybody thinks that it's a good thing for countries to move from low human development index to a higher one. Okay, a better quality of life, a longer life expectancy, more education and the opportunities that education brings, more available income. Those are all things that we want everybody in the world to have. And so we do international aid as a government. We do, hunger campaigns where we try to use our resources to help these other countries develop. We have things like the Peace Corps that is doing work to bring more development. And in the last 30 years or so, the United Nations has set development goals, and we're very consciously trying to bring the modern world, in a sense, to everyone. Good sanitation systems, clean water, abundant food, energy, healthcare, medicine, electricity. Okay, this is one we're going to talk about. Okay, so we're going to put those two ideas together. This is one of my, I could spend hours talking about this graph, and maybe you've seen something like it before. But this x-axis is per capita energy use. That's our one chart of gigajoules per person, right? And here's the United States at about 300, right? You notice the United States isn't the wealthiest country in terms of energy use. Canada, Qatar, Iceland, Trinidad and Tobago. These countries, and if you look at all of them on here, are very energy abundant. Right? Iceland has tons of geothermal sources. Trinidad and Tobago is rich in natural gas as a Caribbean country. Qatar is rich in natural gas, the largest natural gas reservoir that we know of. Canada is rich in fossil fuel resources, but also hydroelectric sorts of things. Okay, this other axis is the Human Development Index. Okay, so our rich countries, our developed countries are here 0.8 and higher. Our very poor countries in Central Africa are down here at the bottom. And you notice this kind of a curve here. It's very clear that as energy, there's a correlation between energy access, energy availability, and development in this end of the curve. It appears that at some point, you don't need any more energy to be developed, to have a modern lifestyle. And so who knows what this all this extra energy goes to. I've not been able to get an exact handle on it. Some of it might be mobility. Right? We do a lot more traveling long distances. So, I don't know that I want to call that wasting energy, but we're using a lot more energy than an energy-poor country. It might have to do with our techno-gadgetry. We have lots of things that aren't really, your cell phone doesn't really improve your human development index, okay? But it takes energy, right? Now, the phone itself doesn't take a lot of energy, but if you take all of the services behind your cell phone, it takes about as much energy as your refrigerator to run your cell phone and everything it does. So it is a big player. Okay, so, I got the sweet spot mark there with the red circle. And this is the point at which it appears that you're sufficiently developed that you, you know, share the modern developed lifestyle with all of the other energy-rich countries. But, you know, there's a little curve here, and a little break in the curve. I'm going to call that 135 in my calculations that I'm going to do in a minute with you. And that happens to correlate very closely with the per person, per capita energy use of European countries. Okay. So we might think we could have a better world overall if we could bring all of this up to here. And maybe those of us at this end could, you know, not be as wasteful, if we want to use that word, or not be as reckless with our use of energy. I'm not sure that's going to happen, and there's really not that many people that are involved in this high energy lifestyle. So, but you'll see how this figures into the calculations. It's not trivial to say, well, let's take the extra energy that these countries use and give it to these countries. Okay, energy doesn't work that way. You can't just take my extra electricity from Fort Collins and give it to Central African countries in a trivial sense. But that's the idea. Okay, so we're really close to the punchline here. But before, what we're gonna do is we're gonna ask, can we do this, and is that reasonable? Is it feasible to think that we could bring these countries, and you know, by 2100, have everybody kind of in a developed lifestyle? Okay. So I have a series of scripture verses here. I'm not going to read through all of them, but they're really emphasizing the idea that those of us who have ought to share with those who do not have. Okay, so the leaving the gleaning passage in Leviticus. Defending the weak and fatherless, uphold the cause of the poor and oppressed, remember the poor. Paul writes in Galatians, bear one another's burdens, do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the house, to the family of believers. But he doesn't just say, you know, be nice and give abundantly to Christians, but to all people. And then, you know, this passage in Matthew, our abundance can turn into idolatry, right? And we, you know, a consumerist mentality we can be making money an idol. And so, as Christians, you know, we have plenty of reasons to not hold tightly to our own possessions, and to be generous and liberal in giving them to others and helping others with them. Okay, here's a couple more. We brought nothing into the world. Chuck Swindoll used to say, have you ever seen a hearse with a U-Haul? Okay. Give away your possessions. Give away your iPhone and follow Jesus. Right? Might be a translation. Okay, so we're going to now build these assumptions to get to 2100. All right, so now here's the global population estimate for 2100. There's a slide about this, but I'll just mention it right now. You and I, many of us here, grew up hearing that the biggest problem in the world is world population, population growth. And we've got to do something to slow it down and stop it. Otherwise, you know, we're going to use up all the planet's resources. We're not going to be able to have enough food for everybody. You know, those cries were in the 70s, And now 50 years later, we've had the Green Revolution, and we're feeding the world just fine. Obesity has become probably more of a problem than world hunger. And people who aren't getting enough food, it's probably because of corrupt governments and inappropriate or inadequate distribution systems. It's not because there's not enough food. Okay. But the latest estimates, because development is happening, and when development happens, population growth rates go down. If you want to control world population or a country's population, the best way to do that is to educate women and girls and to, you know, make some birth control options available so that they can choose what kinds of families they want to have. And most people, it appears, when they have abundant economic resources, choose to limit their family size. And so most developed countries in the world have near zero population growth. U.S. is a little bit of an exception because there's just a lot of immigration happening here, and population is growing for many reasons. But if you just look around the globe, I mean, even in a country like Bangladesh, which we might have in our heads as a country with a population problem, the population rate has gone down significantly in the past decade or two, and it's no longer a serious problem. And there's more economic prosperity in Bangladesh. I've got three options there, but those bottom two, medium and low population estimates, are what we're now thinking is going to be happening in the world. I've even read essays that say our biggest future problem is going to be not enough people to do the economy that needs to be done to support all the old people. Okay. So I don't think we should be too fearful of robots replacing our job. As the population is going to level out or even turn downward, we're just not going to have the problem. The human population has probably doubled for the last time. Okay, we're at 8 billion right now. We're not ever going to get to 16 billion, it looks like. And especially if economic development still continues, we're just going to see this worldwide, and we're going to stabilize at replacement or less populations. All right, so I'm going to, for this talk, make the assumption that we're going to stable off here at 10 billion. Okay, it's just because 10 billion is a good round number, and it's going to be easy to do the calculations, but 10 billion is going to be the population in 2100. Okay, and it's not going to be growing dramatically. All right, so that's kind of assumption number one. Here's the slide, I guess. We had a speaker on video last month who thought that population problem is serious, and we need to really work on that. My response to that is there's nothing we can do to keep the world population from getting to 10 billion unless we deliberately go out and kill people or let reopen the smallpox vials that we have one and Russia has one. But otherwise, there's no smallpox anywhere in the world. There's nothing to do. I mean, we're actually doing it. We've already done it by doing development, by educating people, by providing some birth control options for women who've never had it before. The population problem is going to settle down. Now, 10 billion might be still too many. Okay, and some people think that it's above the carrying capacity of the planet. But, you know, unless we're willing to deliberately reduce the population, I don't think there's anything that we're going to be able to do in the next 30, 40, 50 years that is going to change this this reality. Okay, so very quickly, I want to ask the question, is it reasonable to think that we can kind of improve the condition of people in the world? Have we made any progress? We've been working on this for, you know, 50 years or so. People have been thinking about international aid and Peace Corps, and the Christian Church has been involved in a lot of aid. So just a really quick state of the world here. And I want to point you particularly to this man here, Hans Rosling. He just passed away a couple years ago. If you don't know Hans Rosling, he's a World Health Organization statistician, physician. Amazing videos and lectures on YouTube. I just, you know, type into Google Hans Rosling and the washing machine, and it's a fabulous talk, about 35 minutes. So anyway, I'm going to use him as the guide to we're making progress. The person who I'm going to compare him to is Paul Ehrlich. Anybody know that name? Paul, what's he famous for?
Population bomb.
The population bomb. Right, so he's the person in the 70s who said the world is going to come to an end by the end of 1980, or the 80s, okay? And we're going to starve ourselves, and there's going to be massive disease. So he's the ecologist, he's a biologist in his background, who's the pessimist about the world. So I've got some slides, some numbers here. Paul Ehrlich compared to Hans Rosling. So Ehrlich's numbers are in the 60s, 70s. Rosling's numbers are newer. So just to give you a feel for how the world is getting better, if you want to think of it that way. So fertility rate, 5 compared to 2.2. That's the number of kids per family, okay? How many people get the measles vaccine around the world? Well, apparently people in New York don't anymore. But 49% versus 85%. DPT vaccine, 15% in the 80s versus 86% today. This is worldwide, okay? Infant mortality, 118. That's deaths per 100,000, I think. Compared to 40 today. Life expectancy, 53 compared to 70, right? The average life expectancy around the world has gone up considerably. Literacy, 56% compared to 86%. Electrification, 75% compared to 85%. Population growth rate, 2.1% compared to 1%. Okay, when you get to 0%, that's when you're steady state, right? That's when you're keeping the population the same. It's kind of where we want to be. Poverty rate, 44% in 1980. This is people who make less than $1.90 a day. 9.6 today, okay? War deaths. This is a fascinating statistic because we have so much war in the news. That you'd think it's much worse today than it has been in the past. But in 1971, 8.5 deaths per 100,000 compared today to fewer than one. And the GDP per capita, okay, gross domestic product, that's an economic measure, 2,800 in 1980, 10,000 in 2070. Anybody know what the U.S. GDP per person is? It's 50,000 to 60,000. Okay.
Are you taking into account inflation in some of this too, though?
No, these are all, well, the money ones are inflation adjusted. They're inflation adjusted. Okay, so, you know, I look at this and I think, wow, this is amazing. We are making a lot of progress. And we can, you know, I think it's not unreasonable to say we're going to eliminate poverty in the next decade or two. That's not an unreasonable goal for us. If you want to, you know, you can scan the internet for Hans Rosling. He conveys this message. There was a book out a year or two ago by Steve Pinker, philosopher. Jim, is Pinker a philosopher or is he a?
No.
Okay. And anyway, he has written a book on the world's getting better. By almost every measure that we look at. Okay, so this is the bottom line. I've got several slides after this, but this is the bottom line take-home message. So if you guys want to leave after this, you can. All right. So what's the global energy demand in 2100? Simple calculation at this point. 10 billion people, and we're going to use the little knee on that curve of 135 gigajoules per person. All right, multiply those two numbers together, and you get the world energy need when the population is 10 billion, and when development has occurred to bring everybody along to that point on the curve. And you get 1,350 exajoules. Okay, now anybody remember how much? Oh, I guess I put it down there. the world, 566, that's today. That's how much energy the world consumes. If we're going to get to developed societies with 10 billion people, we're going to need about three times, 2 to 3 times as much energy. Okay? So, we're not only talking about, you know, getting all the energy green, like the Green New Deal is calling for, which has a vast budget associated with it. Of course, they're only looking 10 years down the road, or 20 maybe. But we need to triple that to get the whole world on board. All right, here's a little video clip that just illustrates this point. Hang on just a second. Let me go ahead and play this. Woke you up, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
When you start running those numbers, it's sobering exercise. And you may not be able to get that number exactly right, but you realize we're going to basically double the amount of energy we consume by 2050. We're probably going to triple it or quadruple it by the end of the century. And meanwhile, if you want to stabilize emissions at some reasonable level, almost all of that energy has to be clean energy. You've got to not only, you know, create a clean energy infrastructure to replace the fossil fuel infrastructure we have, but we have to create yet another one, or maybe two of them, between now and 2050 or 2100 in order to reduce our emissions to stabilize the climate. And that is just nothing that anybody that's really been talking about or dealing with for the last 20 years.
Okay, so this, I just think that's a cool way to illustrate that you know, we're doubling, tripling energy use, the brighter lights at night from all parts of the world. That was Mike Schellenberger, Was part of, and the video clip is from Pandora's Promise, a video that came out a few years ago. It's a story, a documentary about some environmentalists who think we need to go nuclear to solve this this problem. Jim,
you, I forgot what I was going
to say. Oh no, I'm sorry.
Occasionally, you were saying, there's different we's that could be here. Sometimes is it we the whole world, uh-huh. We the Christian community,
right?
Right.
A great question. So, you know, most of the time the we is the world. We as the human, as humanity, is what I'm getting to. But, you know, as we touch base with our, our role as stewards, as servants, as you know, we do what we can to help this process along. Okay. I want to make sure we have plenty of time for questions and discussion. That's the bottom line. But let me just throw out something that might tweak you a little bit. So, water is going to be a problem too. As we generate this much energy and have this many people, are we going to have enough water to irrigate our crops, to drink what we need, to use water for sanitation purposes? So I'm going to do very quickly. I'm not going to go through it as slowly as I did. But we're going to add in, we're going to solve the water problem with energy. Okay? So this is just a water use chart for the United States, how water is used. It's kind of interesting that most water, 50% of the total amount of water that's used per day in the United States is to cool coal plants and nuclear power plants, because we turn water into steam and we have to get it back into water to use it again. And so a lot of water in that process. But I'm going to focus on the irrigation and public water supply. So those two numbers. All right. And so here's one slide that has all of the calculations. And again, if you want to let your eyes glaze over it, you can, and just catch the bottom line. But for those two purposes, we use 160 billion gallons of water per day. We do that on a per person basis for the United States. These numbers are from a couple years ago because the water data is not that recent. 492 gallons per person per day. All right, is our water use in irrigation and, clean water use in our homes. All right, so we take that per person per day, multiply by 10 billion people. Okay, so let's let the whole world use as much water as we do. Let's get gallons per year just to get us on a per year scale. So we need 1.8 times 10 to the 15th gallons of fresh water per year, right? You can't use ocean water to drink or to irrigate your crops. This number here is the way to convert from volume of water to energy if you're using this process known as reverse osmosis to purify water. All right, so reverse osmosis is like ultrafiltration. You pump water through these membranes. They have tiny pores, and salt doesn't go through, but the water does. Water can. All right, and so that's 68,000 joules, back to our energy unit, per gallon. Okay, and so we multiply our 1.8 times 10 to the 15 gallons per year times 68,000 joules per gallon, and we get 122 exajoules. Now, we probably don't need to make that much water because we're not water sparse everywhere, right? Ask Nebraskans today how water sparse they are. That's kind of an upper bound. 122 exajoules. All right, that's a lot of energy. That's the amount of energy that a whole country uses, a whole developed country. But, you know, in 2100, it's not a very large percentage of our total. All right, now, I was hoping some water guys would be here and they would, you know, nail me on how weird and unreasonable and crazy this is. You know, Josh is close. He maybe will do it for me. But anyway, if we add that to our 1350, we get 1472. Okay, that's the global energy need for 2100. Okay. 1500 exajoules, three times. Right, it doesn't change the number all that much. Okay, now, what does that mean in terms of where we are today? Well, the first thing that I want to point out is that, and Schellenberger did this in the video clip, this has to be clean energy. Right? We can't continue to make, and you know, I'm not here tonight to give you the lecture on climate change and global warming and CO2 emissions. You know, if you ask questions about it, I can talk more about that. But this is carbon-free energy that has to provide that energy in 2100 and throughout the century, actually. Okay, so it's nuclear, hydroelectric, wind. I'm going to always put storage. Whenever you use wind or solar, you have to have battery backup because the wind doesn't blow all the time, the sun doesn't shine all the time, geothermal. I'm even going to allow fossil fuels to continue to be used if we develop carbon capture. So there are proposals and technologies out there that you take the stuff that's coming out of the smokestack at a coal plant that's got lots of carbon dioxide in it, and you suck out the carbon dioxide and, you know, turn it into rocks or turn it into, you know, pressurized liquid CO2 that you put in the ground. Or you turn it into plastic polymers. Just don't let it go into the ocean. Right. Anyway, I'm going to allow that. I mean, that's a carbon-free technology. Okay. But we need all of that. And where are...
In that order?
No. This is just a random list. Today, we only have 2,000 1-gigawatt carbon-free power plants. Okay. Now, what you can't tell from this, and I need to do this, I'm going to go real fast here. 1 gigawatt, that's a typical big power plant. Okay. Our coal plant in northern Colorado is 280 megawatts. All right, so it's a smallish power plant. But a gigawatt power plant is kind of an average number that I want us to work with. So we have 2,000 today. Well, how much energy is a gigawatt power plant? Okay? So how much does a 1 gigawatt power plant produce in a year? This is another one of those grocery store Old Chicago's calculations. Okay? So a gigawatt is a gigajoule per second. Convert seconds, let's convert to joules first. So there's a billion joules, and then let's convert to years. Okay, 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, 24 hours in a day, 365 days in a year. You know, you all can do that calculation. And convert it to exajoules. 1 gigawatt power plant produces 0.0315 exajoules per year. Okay. So we have 2,000 of those today that are producing clean energy. All right. So here's the way I'm going to run this calculation. 1,472, that was the total amount of energy we need in 2100. We're going to divide by the amount produced by a single gigawatt power plant. So we need 46,730 clean energy power plants in order to meet this energy demand by 2100. We have 2,000 today, clean. We have lots more that are not clean. But basically, we don't have any clean power plants compared to what we need.
How many of those are nuclear?
There are about 400 nuclear power plants in the world, 100 in the U.S. That's...
But those do way more than 1 gigawatt.
No. Each reactor typically does 1 gigawatt.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big... A gigawatt is a big... A gigawatt coal plant is a huge coal plant. All right, so we need 44,700 clean power plants in the next 81 years. Okay. Now, to get you to grasp that number, divide 44,730 by 81. We need to build 539 clean power plants per year for the next 81 years. Okay. Let me jump to this slide first. Last year we built 73. Okay, 73 new power plants. If we put a price tag on these, a gigawatt power plant, $5 billion, no matter what the technology is. It's a little higher for nuclear, a little lower for coal and natural gas. But we don't want to build coal and natural gas power plants. Solar farms, wind farms are about this much price by the time you get it up to 1 gigawatt. Okay, so that's $1 trillion for each of the next 83 years. Okay, so the Green New Deal price tag doesn't seem all that bad right now. Now, they're proposing that the government pay for all of that. I'm not sure it has to be the government that pays for all of that. But this amount of money, $2 to $5 billion times 539 power plants is $1 to $3 trillion. And that's 1 to 3% of the GWP, right? It's not the gross domestic product, gross world product. So the world makes about $100 trillion a year. U.S. is 20 trillion or 19 trillion in its GDP. Okay, so 1 to 3% to build what we need to meet world energy demands then. This is technically the last slide. I do have a few more, but I'm going to hold them off and see if a question comes up that you might want to explore them. But basically, we need to move on this. And this is kind of a big thud conclusion here. I don't have a lot of answers. I don't know how we're going to do this, but we need to get going on providing this energy infrastructure for the world. Now, obviously, today we're meeting the demand, although there are lots of undeveloped countries in the world. But as those countries develop, we're going to have to step it up and get to where we need to be.
Terry, on this slide itself, the world builds the equivalent of 73. Were those clean energy plants?
Those are clean 1 gigawatt clean energy plants. They built more energy than that. China's building lots of coal. India's building lots of coal. So there's other energy resources, and that's taking care of some of the development problems. Okay, I will not have a problem with that. But in the long run, this new energy has to be carbon-free, or the CO2 emissions are going to be unmanageable. Let me stop there. And, you know, maybe you've had enough. But let's, if there are any questions, comments, I'm happy to let you take me on, point out my math errors. I'd love to think that it's not this bad. Any comments or questions? Yeah.
It seems like going back to the original curve where the patterns, that maybe there are a lot of ways, and I don't know what they are, but to increase quality of life without increasing energy assumption. I mean, you've got those
right. So,
there, but they're not necessarily connected.
I didn't say that. Didn't say this, but I actually think I think it's true that this is not just correlation here. That energy access is what allows development. And you can think about things like, electricity a luxury or is it a necessity? Right? I mean, if you think about refrigeration in particular, and the way you can provide clean water and clean up dirty water that's been used to, you know, take care of human waste. Those things all require electricity and power. If you think about lighting, and you know the day can keep going even after it gets dark, and so there's opportunities there for education and commerce that aren't there if you don't have more daytime, if you will, and I think you can think of others, food production, medical care, to get to these higher quality of life situations, you need energy, and so you know, does it have to be a nuclear power plant? Well, no, right. And a lot of people are doing off-grid solar that can solve some of these issues. And a lot of countries are building hydro where they can. That's a clean energy form.
I was going to say, it seems like it will have to be decentralized, the energy production. It seems kind of obvious.
Well, I mean, in a sense, that's the way we do it.
Yeah. I mean,
right? We have a grid where it's all connected together, but, you know, every town, every community has a fairly near, close by power source.
But, I mean, even almost the individual level, with solar cells on houses,
Just because you mentioned that, there's an interesting story. I mean, you know, it's great to have solar cells on rooftops and provide lighting, and you know, there's a lot of effort put into providing solar. And you see these pictures of solar panels on these thatch roofs, but there's a light bulb now inside the house, and there's some resources. But it's not enough to run a refrigerator.
Well, the problem is they're terribly inefficient.
Right, right.
I mean, 10 or 15% is being converted.
Right. But it's not enough to run a refrigerator.
But the efficiency was higher.
So people who are getting this say, we want real electricity. We want, you know, and what they mean is kind of grid-based electricity. So they can run all their electrical appliances.
Well, we have 18 panels on our house, uh-huh. And we run everything.
Uh-huh.
We break even on our electricity.
Yep. No, that's great. That's great. I mean,
but
18 panels, that cost you $15,000 too, right?
No,
well,
not that much. Half that. But anyway, the problem is we're also creating waste. I talked about this, the fact that when those solar panels are used up, they're no good anymore. You're creating waste now.
Right. And you should see what it takes to build a solar panel.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, speaking as a geologist, you know, I think of the extraordinarily earth costs that are required to make photovoltaics. I mean, I'm all for concentrating solar energy on the towers and using the turbine. That's actually more efficient and uses way less rare earth elements. I mean, when you look at the extraordinary destruction in China, in some of those rural parts of China, where you see almost the chemical fog, that sort of thing. That has to do significantly with rare earth element extraction. They're driving their photovoltaic industry. So decentralizing that and making that happen everywhere, first of all, there's not enough rare earth elements to do that. Secondly, even if there were, the environmental cost locally would be extraordinary.
Well, you notice that we don't do it here, right? China makes all our rare earths, because we don't want that pollution in the United States.
And those at the far right, Iceland does most of the world's aluminum processing. We use their aluminum. We send our bauxite ore there to get processed, or Jamaica's bauxite ore, and it gets processed next to the clean energy. So the ones at the far right are often outsourcing energy needs of the wealthy nations. So that's to be factored in, too.
Right. Lynn, you had a...
Yeah, do you have any idea how China and India are developing their energy right now as they're raising their development index? They're using more energy. And you mentioned they're building a lot of coal, but they also talk a lot about clean energy. But what are they actually doing?
Right. So certainly China is doing all of the above.
But
so China is one of the leaders in solar and wind development in terms of absolute magnitude. They're the fastest growing nuclear countries, and they've slowed down a little bit, but nuclear has gone forward there. Coal has gone. They're cutting back on coal because of the pollution issues that they're trying to take care of, and so they're doing all of the above. The largest solar farms in the world are in India today. But they're building a lot of coal as well. So, you know, both China and India, I didn't put it in my slide set, but I have a slide in the book showing China's energy use growth over the last decade. And it's striking how fast and how large. I mean, it's gone from being that, you know, 74 gigajoules per person, and now you multiply that times 1.3 billion people, and then work hard to make more and more and more energy, and you know, they're up to now 134 exajoules for the country. So they're beginning to flatten off on that growth curve that we went through in the 30s, 40s, 50s in the U.S. But India is just about 10 or 15 years behind China.
Well, as you make the point of your whole talk being how much energy will we need to reach this level of development 80 years into the future, more detail about China and India would be very interesting because they are the test case at the moment. They're in this transition already. So,
China is they're still building up like crazy.
Yeah.
But they're tailing off of that. Africa is going to be next.
What are the main energy sources in Africa? Obviously, solar in the northern part.
Well, yeah. There's.
Do they have a lot of natural gas or coal?
They don't, actually. I mean, coal is but there's not a lot there. So renewables, but coal is importable, and South Africa has lots of coal, and there's attempts to do hydro on the Congo and other sources and. But one of the things that, I guess I would call it good news to some extent is that we build our energy infrastructure as the need arises. Mm-hmm. So I'm describing a need that's going to be, when the world is fully developed down the road. We don't have to be there today. But if we don't start working toward that goal, you know, it's going to be really, really hard to get there in a timely fashion.
Well, one other comment is that your talk ends, and what's still in my head is, but we're going to grab, when we get in a pinch, we're going to grab the coal, we're going to grab the natural gas, and that's what we're going to build, because that's the easiest. And what does that mean for climate change? And are we just going to sacrifice the climate for getting that energy available to the people that are now developing, and they want vaccines and refrigeration and so on and so forth?
I mean, I think at some point we will... I mean, it has to be a decision. I mean, even if we could cut back by 50% in fossil fuel use, I mean, we really need to go to zero, if we really look at the numbers. But you know, cutting back significantly by implementing new solutions, and that's what, at least in the U.S., we're doing. We're implementing some gas, but gas is better than coal, and so we're replacing coal with gas, but then we're building out, you know, nuclear still has a pretty negative stigma on it, but the new generation, fourth generation nuclear is getting a lot of publicity and press, and I think...
Are there any countries looking favorably at nuclear at this point?
Well, China.
China. Anything in Europe?
Iran.
Iran.
Europe's been kind of running from nuclear.
Right, so Europe is, they're turning away. I mean, even, you know, Switzerland and Sweden and France that have been really strong nuclear centers are, you know, talking about dismantling their nuclear in the next 50 years.
It just seems crazy.
The present generation and, you know, previous generation of nuclear is really not as safe as the newer proposals. But the newer proposals are untested, and you know, we don't actually have any of them really built and operating. But allegedly, they're a lot safer.
Yeah. Two things: one, we have working against us is a lot of regulations prevent putting up new plants. The other thing is, we do have going for us, we are becoming much more efficient also. You take that one solar panel that you talked about in the grass hut and the light bulb, well, that light bulb can now take, you know, a fraction of the energy it did. So we do have some things working for us on the positive side.
Although what's interesting about that, and this is a dilemma economists talk about, is that, you know, all efficiency gains get filled in by new uses for electricity.
RS3 light bulbs or 10 light
bulbs.
Well, one of the things you talked about is, suppose I agree with everything you said about the way it's going to be in 2100, or it's going to be close to it. You talked about a faith perspective of this that you were going to give. So that raises all kinds of things. You know, how does the Christian community relate to the secular community, mm-hmm. and then the world community, and what are we willing to, you know, how much force are we willing to use to get us to where we should be, so to speak, and, you know, do we let markets do it, do we do a Marxist analysis, do we do a postmodern analysis, you know, what are those, where the faith enters in, how does that look?
Maybe some of those choices are faith-driven. I'm currently in a Facebook debate with a friend, and, you know, I'm the neoliberal and he's the socialist. So, and we're both Christians, and so we're not seeing eye to eye necessarily. And you know, the whole question of, this talk wasn't about climate change, but as Lynn pointed out, it's intimately involved. You know, the questions, you know, why do evangelicals and maybe politically conservative folks tend to be more skeptical of climate change and those problems than others? And part of the reason is the fear of, I think, the fear of regulation, and the some of the solutions that are offered for taking care of climate change issues involve big government service. Okay, I didn't say that, but big government solutions.
Yeah.
And so, I like to say, I tell my students, science doesn't tell us what to do. It tells us what will happen if we do such and such, if we have good modeling and predictive science. But it's our decision based on perhaps non-scientific claims and issues that help us decide. So, maybe it's not worth giving up your liberties in order to solve this problem, and you work for other solutions.
I mean, if $3 trillion, there are other issues at stake, like medicine, like the money could be used elsewhere.
Yeah, sure.
For human good also.
Right. Yep.
The last number
see you guys.
You put up to solve this, we need a 1-3% increase in GWP, and
I don't say an increase. We just need to use 1-3% of GWP for this cause.
Either way, that doesn't seem particularly onerous. But yet the numbers I've seen out of Ocasio are apocalyptic.
Well,
if I remember.
Yes.
So what's the difference?
Right. Well, okay. So. I went to the 10th anniversary of the School of Global Environmental Sustainability. The celebration was this week, so the CSU campus has this. And there was a speaker who pointed out that the way the Green New Deal is being communicated is that this is all government spending, and it's all based on taxes. And we're just going to have to tax people so we could pay for this, trillion-dollar bill to take care of this. And he pointed out that that may be what it sounds like. And I kind of hear that when I hear that proposal. But the what's really going to happen is. You're going to have the private, at least in the United States, you're going to have the private sector take on some of these challenges and maybe even profit from meeting them. There's a lot here, but I'll give you the bottom line. This is a calculation estimating the cost of a 1 gigawatt 24-hour solar farm, okay, which means you actually have to overbuild. You have to have more than 1 gigawatt because the sun doesn't shine 3/4 of the time, and you have to have storage to it. So by my really back-of-the-envelope calculation, and I never did say that, but that's what the envelope means. All these things are back-of-the-envelope calculations, right? So... where was it? 1.8 billion for a 1 gigawatt solar farm that provided 1 gigawatt of electricity 24 hours a day. So that includes overbuilding and battery storage. So building the thing is 6 billion, storage is 1.8 billion. Okay. And that storage, there are interesting proposals coming out. We don't have to have standalone batteries at the power plant. Maybe our electric cars can store some of the grid electricity. And then you get paid for having a car that is used that way. But anyway, the bottom here it was an interesting little calculation. So. If you charge 10 cents a kilowatt hour for electricity and you have a 1 gigawatt power plant that lasts 25 years, which is, you know, a good number for solar, you're going to make $21 billion. Now, a lot of people, I mean, the solar guy who tried to sell me solar panels said that electricity was going to be, in 20 years, was going to be 18 cents a kilowatt hour. And that I would be protecting myself against that future.
10 cents is the current rate?
10 cents is the average, certainly in Colorado. So, $21 billion. All right, loan me $21 billion. I mean, loan me where is it here? 7.8. Yeah, 7.8. Loan me $7.8 billion. I'll build the solar plant. And then over the course of 25 years, I'll make $14 billion back above and beyond. Now, yeah. Pay for the financing and
there's an interest cost.
And all of that too, but and operations costs. So you know you're not going to make $14 billion, but you know you could make a livelihood off of that. And and the government's not paying for it. Maybe the government can do some loan guarantees, right? You know, provide some services that allow these kinds of things to happen. But they don't have to pay for it. All right, anything else? Any other questions?
Good, because the government takes it out of my pocket.
Well, thank you for coming, and please pick up some literature. I don't want to take it home with me.
Thanks for your work.